listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. As we all know, the hunt for an exploration of water brought the city of Los Angeles to life. Literally, it brought life to Los Angeles. So tonight, in this dry city, we will reflect on the element of water with two celebrated writers, Craig Childs and Kathleen Dean Moore. Their work is deeply influenced by their relationship with water, with rivers, with streams, with tinajas, or water pockets, flash floods, with rain. They'll read from their work, and they will explore, with moderator Bill Devereaux, how storytelling, in the tradition of Thoreau and Emerson, can give voice to natural resources. We went for a wonderful walk on the LA River today. We wanted to introduce them to one of the wonders of Los Angeles, so they may be talking about that as well. In his extraordinary book, The Secret Knowledge of Water, Craig Childs explains how his mother was born next to a spring in the desert, how at an early age he understood that, quote, water was the element of consequence, the root of everything out there. Craig is the guy you want to be hiking with in the desert, the kind of naturalist who can locate water in a completely parched landscape by following the drone of bees. I kid you not. Kathleen Dean Moore, as Scott Russell Sanders writes, quote, feels the ache of truth in her bones. She's the writer who reminds you that when you live, make it all. Don't wait for the rain to stop. Climb out of your tent with your mind engaged and your senses ablaze, and let rain pour into you. Her knowledge of the natural and human worlds is intimate, and for those who read her, deeply healing. Craig Childs now lives in Colorado. He's a writer who focuses on natural sciences, archaeology, and remarkable journeys into the wilderness. He's published more than a dozen critically acclaimed books on nature, science, and adventure. He's won several key awards, including the 2011 Ellen Molloy Desert Writers Award and the 2003 Spirit of the West Award for his body of work, an honor he shares with Wallace Stegner, Terry Tempest Williams, and N. Scott Momaday. He's an Arizona native, and he grew up back and forth between there and Colorado. Kathleen Dean Moore is an essayist and activist who writes about cultural and spiritual connections to wet, wild places. Her award-winning books include River Walking, Hold Fast, The Pine Island Paradox, and Wild Comfort, The Solace of Nature. And her newest book is Moral Ground, Ethical Action for a Planet in Peril, in which she gathered calls from the world's moral leaders to honor our obligations to future generations. Kathleen Dean Moore is Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at Oregon State University, where she directs the Spring Creek Project for Ideas, Nature, and the Written Word. And William Devereaux is an author and professor of history at USC, where he specializes in the history of California and the American West, and directs the Scholarly Institute that collaborates with the Huntington Library in Pasadena. And his most recent book is Whitewashed Adobe, The Rise of Los Angeles and the Remaking of Its Mexican Past. It is a great pleasure to welcome, please join me in welcoming, Kathleen Dean Moore, Craig Childs, and William Devereaux to the LA Public Library. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. Thanks for coming. Thank you, Louise. I'm delighted to be with you all and with these two distinguished panelists this evening. It's a great pleasure to collaborate with Louise Steinman, the Los Angeles Public Library, and the Los Angeles Public Library Foundation on this Elemental West series. As Louise mentioned, we spoke nearly a year ago with Steve Pine and Colleen Morton Bush on Fire in the West, and this evening we turn to another key element, water. I'll try not to exhaust the seduction of water as metaphor here tonight, but it's fitting, given the range of experience, work, and passion of our two guests this evening, that tonight's discussion will run here and there. It will pool in intellectual and philosophical depth, and then it'll move off to follow the dictates of curiosity, mystery, and the fervent calls for action. I'd like to begin by asking this evening for Craig and Kathleen to read excerpts from their writing. This will help introduce the two of them to you all and their ideas as well. It'll give us some terrain upon which to move forward with our discussion here on stage, and their words are likely to spark questions or comments from you all when we later turn to question and answer at the end of our session. So, Craig, may we start with you?
Sure. Hi, everybody. Well, I am accustomed to traveling in deserts and looking for water out in fairly dry places, but I'd like to start someplace else. A week ago, I was in Jamaica, looking for caves back in the jungle in the interior of the island. I was looking for pre-Columbian rock art. And going back into the jungle places where there are mouths of caves that are just covered with strangler fig, you know, just the place is just wild and thick and wet. Everything is wet. There's the interior of the island is riddled with caves, rivers flowing underground, blue holes that are coming up from 100 meters below, rivers just coming out of the ground. It's not something you're used to in a dry country. And so I had to look at things a little bit differently there. But still, it's water. You go into places where there is water, and it is the same powerful thing. I mean, sometimes I think you turn on the faucet, and it's still water. It's still this magical element. It's as if the water will do its job anywhere. It will leave its imprint no matter where it is. I find sometimes that when there's a car wash going on up the street, I'll be following that little finger of water as it's coming down the curb, as it's picking up pieces of trash or whatever, and it's still magical. It's still an amazing thing to see water moving. And I wanted to, of course, I lost my bookmark, but this is I'm reading from my journal from Jamaica, which big theater cave. Drop steeply through boulders into water, dripping, looking up into a bright sky, crowded with a wall of green and a single elegant palm tree outside, frog, a tiny squeak, like something almost said. At night, the jungle sings with peepers, little koki frogs everywhere. Bats rumble in the hollow belly of a palace ceiling chamber. Water drips, drops, slaps down around me. I taste their drips off the soda straw tips of stalactites, clear beads of water feeding onto my fingertips, smacking my helmet. That's all I have for the written material. But I'll keep. Don't worry, there's more. To be inside of a cave, there is something particular about the sound of a drop of water falling in a pool, that just strum of a water surface echoing back inside of a dark chamber. And there, to be in a place that is so wet, to be in a jungle where the mouths of these caves had rock art on them, pre-Columbian faces carved into the stalactites in the twilight area in between the sun outside and the black inside, and these faces are looking out into the jungle, and you pass them and you go into the places where the water is running. You pass them and go into the underworld. I've always had a fascination for these deep, dark places where water moves inside of the earth. And to be in the jungle where that's happening is one thing, but to be in the desert where it's happening is completely different. To be inside of a cave where water is running in a dry landscape. I remember in the Grand Canyon being in a cave that is putting out this thundering mass of water coming out of a cliff wall and pounding down these waterfalls. I climbed back into this cave in the desert and went inside to get back to the source, to see what it was like to go into the underworld where you hear that galling roar of water all around you, where you're pressing your way through a small passageway wearing a wetsuit, soaked and cold and going deeper into the blackness, wearing your headlamp, the cone of light, going ahead and showing the way through, going into the belly of the earth where you drink the water, where it goes into your body. These are powerful things, but in the desert, it is different. In dry country, it is so different because water is brought to a point in dry country. Water is very different here than it is in other places. Water here stands out. You go out into the desert and every single sign of it is like a miracle. You go back into this cave, into where the galling roar is no longer a roar, where you go to the source and the water is just slowly welling up from a hole in the back of a cave, and you know that hundreds of feet over your head is the desert surface, is the sun baking down on the ground, shad scale and sage, the dry earth above you, while inside you're in the dark and in the cold, and it's like being born again, and you drink that water. I look for water out there. I travel walking through canyons, reading the shapes of boulders, the paths of arroyos, looking for signs of water, anything that suggests that there's something to drink out there. Last month, I was in the Mojave Desert, about 3 hours from Las Vegas on the other side of Lake Mead. And I went out to look at a landscape that I knew nothing about, just some place, some random place, with this idea that you can go out into the land and look at it with your eyes, and even if you don't know it, you'll figure out the right places. You'll look across it and go, there, that's the spot. And I remember driving out there right before sunset and seeing this ripple of sandstone in the distance and going, there's going to be something there. And parking, putting on my full pack to go out for a few days and just going, okay, I'm going to head right through there and there's going to be something. The sun set and I walked through dusk. And in the last light of dusk, I came into a narrow canyon and I saw a bighorn sheep carved up into the rock over me. And I came over a rise and saw more spirals and images all around me. And then I smelled it. I smelled that scent, that wet smell that you pick up out there that just touches the rims of your nostrils. And I followed it. And there was a water hole, a water pocket, a carving inside of the bedrock where old rainwater was sitting. And I just had to smile, just think, I wasn't really looking for this. I was just looking for the right spot. I just looked across the land and said, it's whatever it is, it's going to be over there. And what was it? It was water. It was water with rock art all around, ringing this canyon. You look for these places. You look for the spots. I don't know how you do it. I don't know if there are rules about what to look for, how to know a place, how to move through it. I think you just go out there. You just go out and you look. Where your eye takes you, you travel. You walk there. You look for places of water. After I left the Mojave Desert, I traveled up into South Central Oregon, up into the Summer Lake region, near the town of Paisley, Oregon. And Summer Lake used to be an ice age lake that was 20 miles long, 10 miles wide. It has shrunk several times that size, and it is a much smaller lake now since the ice age is over. And I walked out across this sage plain that used to be water, that all used to be lake water, and now it is just sage. And you know what it's like walking across sage. You don't walk straight. You're waltzing with the sage. You know, you're moving in and out of the sage, and you're looking at the ground and seeing the retreat of this lake over centuries, over thousands of years, seeing the rounded pebbles of what was once beach, seeing the crackled parts where there used to be a marsh. And then I came to the place where this lake had existed 100 years ago, and I saw the lake has been retreating very quickly over the last 100 years, much faster than it has since the ice age ended. All the dams and diversions and ditches have removed the water from this lake, and it's been shrinking. And you walk out, the sage is gone, and nothing is left but evaporite, just this crusty, salty substance where you're crunching through it as you walk, dropping to your ankles, pulling out your feet. And the wind was coming up and blowing this alkali, so there was a fine dust swirling all around me, and I could taste the metal on my tongue. This was water. Not very long ago. This was water only decades ago, as this lake shrinks and shrinks until eventually there may be nothing left. There was water there. A lot of what travel is out here is looking for places where water has been, where water has left its memory. I look for that too. I don't just look for the water holes, the places where you can drink the sweet water out of the rock. I look for the places where water tells its story, where it leaves a mark on the land, and you look down and say, it was here. Thank you.
Thank you, Craig.
Kathleen.
Is to be here, and what a privilege it is to share this stage with Craig Childs. I feel that we're the yin and the yang of water, because you know, he goes out to find water, but to find water, I come home. I spend my winters in Oregon on the west wet side, and I spend my summers in southeast Alaska in the wet part of Alaska, and so I've arranged to be constantly soaked. I was counting up raincoats. I own 7 or 8 raincoats, and they all have this little line of moss coming in right in the seam right here where the shoulder meets the neckline right here. You know, actually, my favorite color is cloudy gray. I might joke about it, but the Willamette River, which runs through my town, really is home to me. And it is the way I orient myself. It's what speaks to me. And the way that water can be a home to me is also the way that I'd like water to be a home for my daughter. So let me just read you one paragraph of the kind of writing that I do about my own home river. This is the Willamette. I wanted my daughter to lie in the tent, pressed between her brother and her father, breathing the air that flows from the Willamette River at night, dense with the smell of wet willows and river algae. I wanted her to inhale the smoke of a driftwood fire in air too thick to carry any sound but the rushing of the river and the croak of a heron startled to find itself so far from home. I wanted the chemical smell of the tent to mix with the breath of warm, wet wool and flood through her mind until the river ran in her veins and she couldn't help but come home again. It's true, isn't it? That rivers run in our veins. It's literally true. And it's true, isn't it, that the river in the mountains and the river in the gutter and the blood that pulses through our children's hearts and the moisture in our minds, it's all one river, and it all flows to the same sea. And it makes me think of coming home in a very, very different way. Let me read a paragraph from Rachel Carson, The Sea Around Us, that I think speaks to this notion of the way that water is our home in a very important way. For the sea, she says, lies all around us. The continents themselves dissolve and pass to the sea in grain after grain of eroded land. In its mysterious past, it encompasses all the dim origins of life and receives, in the end, the dead husks of that same life. For all, at last, return to the sea. To Oceanus, the ocean river, like the ever-flowing stream of time, the beginning and the end. So, in my mind, it's water that helps us understand that this blue-green world is all one, deeply interconnected, deeply interdependent, beautiful and mysterious whole thing. And that the flourishing of all the parts depends on the flourishing of the whole. It's water that teaches us that we're all part of this homeland. And who are we in this beautiful world? We are sloshy things, right? We are sacks of seawater. We are water that has developed the ability to walk uphill. We are water that has developed the ability to celebrate its own beauty in poetry, praise and song. It wasn't so long ago that our ancestors spoke to storms with magical words and prayed to water and cursed it and danced for it. And we are water that has developed the ability to imagine. We've developed the ability to imagine things that have absolutely no relationship to the real world. And we've developed the ability to live in that imagined world so that we can believe, that we can imagine, that we are exceptions to all the rules, even the rules of cause and effect, that we are above this world, apart from it, better than it, in control of it. We can imagine that. We can imagine that we can squander water without squandering our futures. We can imagine that we can poison water without poisoning our children. We can imagine that we can take water without taking it from our children and without taking it from, oh, the birds and the plants and the pond lilies and the algae and all this beautiful, lyrical life. And we can imagine that we could safely ignore the coming climate changes, even though they are going to alter the great hydrological cycles that have sustained our lives for many thousands of years. Even though as the fields dry and the forests burn on the east, and as the seawater inundates the marshes and the aquifers in the west, that we will find ourselves between hell and high water. We can imagine that, but we can't imagine it enough to actually think about doing something about it. So what I've been trying to do in the last few years is try to help that imagining, try to anticipate what a world might be after climate change, or as climate change sinks its teeth into the lives of our family. So I'd like to read you one piece. It's called The Call to Forgiveness at the End of the Day. What you need to know about this is that the dateline is May 25th, 2025. So you see what I'm doing. I'm imagining myself at the end of my life looking back on the changes that have occurred over time. You get it. You're smart people. Okay. All those years, the Swainson's thrushes were the first to call in the mornings. Their song spiraled like mist from the swale to the pink sky. That's when I would take a cup of tea and walk into the meadow. Swallows sat on the highest perches, whispering as they waited for light to stream onto the pond. Oh, there was music in the mornings all those years. In the overture of the day, each bird added its call until the morning was an ecstasy of music that faded only when the diesel pumps kicked on to pull water from the stream to the neighbor's Bing cherry trees. Evenings were glorious, too. Just as the sun set, little brown bats began to fly over the water. Each downward flitter of its wings squeezed its lungs and pumped out another chirp, the way a pump organ exhales Bach. Frogs sang and sang like violins just touched by the bow. They sang while crows flew into the oaks and settled their wings, while garter snakes, their stomachs extended with frogs, crawled finally under the fallen bark of the oaks and stretched their lengths against cold ground. I don't know how many frogs there were in the pond then, thousands, tens of thousands. When the eggs hatched, there were tadpoles. I have seen the shallow edge of the pond black with wiggling tadpoles. There were that many, each with a song growing inside it. In the years when the frog choruses began to fade, scientists said it was a fungus, or maybe bullfrogs were eating the tadpoles. When the bats stopped coming, they said that was a fungus too. When the swallows came in pairs, not flocks, we told each other the flocks must be feeding on insects over a neighbor's pond. The meadow was as empty as the perfect emptiness of a bell, the perfectly shaped absence ringing the Angelus, the evening song, the call to forgiveness at the end of the day. As it happened, that was the spring when our granddaughter was born. I brought her to the pond so she could feel the comfort I had known there for so many years. Killdeer waddled in the mud by the shore, but even then not so many as before. By then the pond had sunk into its warm, weedy places, leaving an expanse of cracked earth. Ahead of the coming heat, butterflies fed in the mud between the cracks, unrolling their tongues to touch salty soil. I held my granddaughter in my arms and sang to her then an old lullaby that made her soften like wax in a flame, molding her little body to my bones. Hushabye, don't you cry. Go to sleep, you little baby. Birds and the butterflies fly through the land. I held her close, weighing the chances of the birds and the butterflies. She fell asleep in my arms, unafraid. I will tell you, I was so afraid. Poets warned us, writing of the heartbreaking beauty that will remain when there's no heart to break for it. But what if it's worse than that? What if it's the heartbroken children who remain in a world without beauty? How will they find solace in a world without wild music? How will they thrive without green water edged with oaks? How will they forgive us for letting frog songs slip away? When my granddaughter looks back at me, I will be on my knees, begging her to say I did all I could. I didn't do all I could have done. It isn't enough to love a child and wish her well. It isn't enough to open my heart to a bird-graced pond. Can I claim to love a morning if I don't protect what creates its beauty? Can I claim to love a child if I don't use all the power of my beating heart to preserve a world that nourishes children's joy? Loving is not a kind of la-di-da. Loving is a sacred trust. To love is to affirm the absolute worth of what you love and to pledge your life to its thriving, to protect it fiercely and faithfully for all time. Ring the angelus for the salmon and the streams. Ring the bells for frogs floating in bent reeds. Ring the bells for all of us who did not save the songs. Mother of God, ring the bells for every sacred emptiness. Let them echo in the silence at the end of the day. Forgiveness is too much to ask. I would pray for only this, that our granddaughter would hear again the little lick of music, the grace note toward the end of a swallow's song. Swallows. There were swallows. They sang like angels in the morning.
Thank you both so very much. The two of you, your writings are, we just heard it, your writings really are saturated. Kathleen's by way of water as service and obligation, and Craig's by way of water as history and adventure. Those, I'll admit, those distinctions are a bit arbitrary tonight because you do run into one another's ideas and passions through the range of your writings. But let's start off with biography. Tell us, if you will, about your own coming of age with water. Long before it became so central in what you think about and what you write about, how did moving water figure into the youthful lives of Craig Childs and Kathleen Moore? Craig?
Well, like you said, the color gray is your favorite, which I don't hear that from many people, and it's my favorite color as well because I remember the gray of rainstorms when I was little in Phoenix, and just the smell of water and my mom taking me up into the desert up into the Superstition Mountains and. You know, we'd see the tadpoles in these little water holes, and I think very early on I saw the difference between dry places and wet places, and the wet places just really stood out for me. And you know, over time, I in my teens became a river guide, and just that's where I said, oh, this is it. This is the thing. We were just talking before we came out on stage about how. You'll be sitting in a canoe on a river, and you'll be alone in the canoe and watching the canyon go by, and then the current will shift, and your canoe will turn, and so your view will just turn, and you'll look up and go, oh, thanks, that's just what I needed, and so I always had this feeling that water was an animated force, that it was an animal in a way.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Kathleen.
Well, I grew up in Cleveland, and my family would go to the Cuyahoga River and watch it burn. Well, you really can't see when it's on fire. It's very hard to see the flames, but what you see is the smoke and the redness reflected up on the bottom of the smoke. It's really quite extraordinary. And my father was a bacteriologist, which meant that we couldn't touch any of the water in Ohio, let alone swim in it. We were allowed to wade, but after we waded, we had to wash our feet. I went to college in Ohio, and all this time I was thinking, is this the way it's supposed to be? Is there anything different from this or better than this? And how much I would see people in their little boats, and I would see them in canoes, and how much I wanted to, you know, be in National Geographic and see be actually in a boat. And so when I went to college in Ohio, you know that freshman guidebook where you say who you are and what you like, and then the upperclassmen look and see who they want to date? Well, I wrote that I liked canoes. And it wasn't that I'd ever been in a canoe, but it was true because, you know, I really liked them. Well, my husband, who was a great, my now husband, who was a great waterman, saw, oh, there's a woman who likes canoes. She's probably pretty experienced. And the rest is history. We moved out to Oregon finding water and filled our boats, filled our garage with boats, and it's been that way ever since.
Great. Okay. Let's talk about two beautiful books. Craig's The Secret Knowledge of Water and Kathleen's River Walking, both of which are meditations on the American West. They're travelogues and they're explorations of mind, body, and spirit. But they're profoundly different in certain ways that you've both alluded to from the podium a bit. Kathleen's book is wrapped around the abundance of riparian water, waters of the mighty Columbia watershed, waters of steelhead and salmon. And hers is a book mixing the solitude of reflection with cascading water. Craig's book is searching for water in the sandstone Southwest, where there are rivers and watersheds, yes, but where the landscape's marked mostly by the absence of obvious water. So we have abundance and absence. Kathleen, tell us a little bit more about that abundance, if that's how you see it, and how abundance shapes your journey in that book. And then upon completing your thought, Craig, if you'd pick up and tell us about that seeming absence, whether it is so, and how absence of water informs your thinking.
It's always interesting to hear people talk about your books. It's always a surprise. I never quite thought of it that way, but I'm grateful for the chance to. Because the fish come into the Oregon rivers mostly during the winter, and because it rains in the winter, the primary experience of being on water is having water coming down on your head and having water underneath you, of sitting in puddles, of trying to brew tea before the water can get into it and cool it down. And so, I guess you're right. There is an abundance of water. I hadn't quite thought of it that way. How does it shape the work? I think it's made me understand that that gratitude is probably the primary or the best relationship a person can have with the land, that that we have a reciprocal relationship with the world, and that it offers us all these gifts without asking anything of us. And what an ungrateful thing it is for us to despoil it or waste it or disregard it. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really shaped, the abundance of it and the gift of it has maybe shaped a moral response to it.
You know, it's when I think about what I'm writing, I think of it as abundance, because when you find a water hole, it's, you know, 20 gallons of water in a sandstone bowl, and it is abundant. And when I set out to write Secret Knowledge of Water, I decided not to write about rivers or large water sources or even politically fought over water. I wanted to look at water on a very small scale, and so I chose springs and flash floods, you know, things that are ephemeral, water holes, streams that appear at night and disappear during the day. And I guess for me, I kind of have to put a frame around things so I can find the thing in the middle, and rivers are sometimes just too big for me, where, oh, it starts up here and it ends there, and there's so much in between, so much coming in. How do you even talk about this? Whereas a water hole, there it is. It's defined, and you can look in it and say, oh, I can see the critters moving around inside of it, so I can name those. I can actually, this is a thing that I can comprehend and understand and write about. But at the same time, it is abundance. I mean, there are plenty of times when it hasn't been, and I guess you're right. I go for scarcity. I look for those moments where you're pushed to the edge, where you realize, oh, this one little bit of water is so important. And I think that the purpose of Secret Knowledge of Water was to draw attention to how important it is by just saying, well, here's your little thimbleful.
Right. Even your gestures. This. Your gestures are about this. Yeah. You know, about
it's,
this
it's
much.
All. Yeah. That's how much I can think at one time.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the phrases that you use, both of you, and even in your titles of your book. So, Kathleen, you've got a jumping-off point that we've borrowed for this evening called Reflections on Moving Water. Mm-hmm. Tease that out for us a little bit, both the reflections and the moving, if you will. Beyond Reflection is meditative. You're a very meditative writer, and you do that very well. What's the surface of the water catching in reflection for you?
Well, you know, I'm an essayist. And I think of my work as being all about the world above and the world below. And I think of the work of an essayist like the work of an osprey, who floats over the water and looks at surfaces and sees the reeds and sees the reflection of light off the pond, always looking, but only seeing reflections of what's really there. And at some point, then the osprey will catch a glimpse of something below the surface, and at that point, the osprey folds its wings and dives and engages that shadow. And it's a very dangerous moment for an osprey because if its legs are extended, its talons will not open. So if it engages a shadow that's very large, I have seen osprey, if it engages a small shadow, it can just flutter up and spray off all this light and go and nourish itself with this fish. If it engages a medium size or a heavier one, I've seen osprey swim with their cupped wings. Every once in a while, an osprey will engage a shadow that's so heavy that it drowns. This is the work of an essayist, to begin by looking and engaging the surface and hungrily, patiently describing what you see on the surface of things, always watching for the shadow. And when you catch a glimpse of something bigger below the surface, you dive through that reflection and you engage that. And sometimes you can bring it to light. Sometimes you struggle a lot, and some of the very best essays are ones where the shadow is just too big and the question is too large and the essayist drowns.
Fabulous. Craig, you've given us the secret knowledge of water as an invitation into the arid Southwest. One meaning is clearly that this is your own knowledge of water hiding in natural clefts and cisterns, but is knowledge also meant to empower the water? Does the water have knowledge?
Yeah, I think of water as having an intelligence or having a way of communicating. And I guess I don't mean that in the way that we logically have intelligence, but when you walk down a slot canyon and you look at the way that it's carved into the stone, it is a language in itself. I mean, today we were at the LA River, we were underneath an overpass together, and you could see when it closed in a bit, all the rocks inside the concrete had been sculpted, and I look at that and I go, well, that's water talking. Is it a metaphor? No, it's yeah. Water talking. Mm-hmm. And so I think of water as having this kind of knowledge that it expresses onto the world. And maybe that's just fluid dynamics. Maybe it's something deeper. I don't know what it is, but I know that you can see it and that it is actually a real thing. And so that idea of the secret knowledge of water is that we have this element here that leaves its messages everywhere it goes. And it is an entity. It is a being.
Terrific. I'm going to deviate briefly from my notes here because you've mentioned our trip to the LA River, which was really lovely and wonderful. Can I ask you each how you, what you made of it? We adore our river out here. It's not a big one, but it's a vastly important one. Just tell us a little bit about your reflections about being there today for the brief visit we took.
I thought that it was a landscape that was full of hope. That's what my first impression was, that it was a wounded place, a desperately wounded place, but that the care and attention that it was getting was really very hopeful. And I think about the ways in which rivers over time, over history, have gathered people together and created communities. And I could see that starting to happen with the bike trail and the parks and so forth, that it was becoming a place where people would come and would increasingly care. So I was quite moved, actually.
When you see it as a wounded place, mm-hmm. I sometimes don't know where to put myself because I look at that and I go, it's wounded, but I'm so excited to see a little bit of like wild something.
Yeah.
that this is, I almost forget about the wound, and I know I can see it. I mean, there was garbage floating down while we were there, but I'm also, I feel like I'm 4 years old and
yeah.
Going, yay, water!
he was leaping around on the rocks.
And I forget the wound, And I sometimes come back and go, no, you've got to remember that. Or do you have to remember that? Does that separate you from it? I think I knew that there would be water, but I had this picture in my mind of concrete and a skim of water kind of moving across it and pooling in places, and to actually get down there and see, oh, there's a riparian zone there, there's a cormorant over there, there's it's going over riffles, it's actually moving around and changing, and it's actually water moving.
And a family of ducks.
Yeah, and a family of ducks that we scare off.
So let's talk about the opposite of change. Let's talk about continuity a bit. In House of Rain, Craig, you write about the Anasazi people, the ancestral Puebloans of the Four Corners region. And though the book's about ruptures in time, it's also very much about continuity, something we spoke of earlier today, a feature often absent in discussions of these early people and their fate. Can you tell us about putting water and continuity together? How do you think about water and the absence of change, cycles of rain and drought, but that go together to express continuity across vast distances?
Well, what we saw today, going down to the LA River, that is continuity. And I think that is one of the most important things, is for whatever reason, to keep a river moving. You don't want to break continuity. I mean, I've traveled down in the Colorado River Delta area, and as you probably all know, the river doesn't reach the sea anymore. And, you know, it's a fascinating landscape of salt flats and mud flats and nothing whatsoever. It's my kind of place where you're just out in this just utter desolation. But the continuity has been broken. And that's, I feel like, we missed something really important there. If you could just keep the thread going somehow. I mean, there's an estuary out there where excess wastewater is being dumped into the Mexican desert and preserving some last little piece. That is some continuity. But breaking the continuity, I don't know what it does, but I think it destroys a lot more than what we see. So I think keeping the water moving is one of the most important things we could do.
Kathleen, if I've got it right, your new book, Moral Ground, is ringing with urgency, but born of discontinuity, that times have changed and grown dire and dark. So take us through discontinuity in water, changes in cycles or changes in regard or changes in practice. Where are those breaks and how can we restore them in the way Craig's talking about restoration?
I'm, forgive me, deeply worried about discontinuities in time. I think that civilizations have brought themselves to their knees throughout history by self-inflicted environmental harm. But I think that this one's different. I think this is a discontinuous. I think this is a discontinuity. I think that never before have humans had the ability to actually change the hydrological cycles. And I would love to know what you think of with your perspectives as historians, but to me, I think this is something that we haven't seen before. And when people talk about the sixth great extinction as if this was just one more extinction, I think it's discontinuous too. I think this is an extinction that we haven't seen before because it's one that we're bringing about through disregard, through our own actions. I see the glaciers melting above the rivers in my state where people have worked very, very hard to restore the salmon runs. But as soon as those glaciers are melted, there will be no rivers left, and so there will be no runs. I think that things are broken all over the world. And so discontinuities is a nice little Latinate term for it, but it's broken. And I think about Leonard Cohen, that wonderful Canadian singer-songwriter, who says in an interview, yes, we live in a broken world and we live with broken hearts, but that's no excuse for anything. We have to sing the brokenhearted hallelujah. So that's the way I see my work, is to try to figure out what are the words to that song. What are the words to the brokenhearted hallelujah?
Well, I'm always looking for the right approach to this because it is so hard to figure out how to look at it.
I know.
I have a new book coming out in the fall, and I originally wanted to call it The Unbroken World, to say that we live in an unbroken world, that parts of it are broken, but the world is still moving. There are opportunities for continuity all over the place. the book ended up being called Apocalyptic Planet, so there you go.
Called that?
That's how it works, right? But I look at the world and I think, okay, yeah, there are a lot of things changing rapidly. There's incredible destruction. But as you do, we look for places of continuity and then focus
that's
there
true.
And say, okay, that's still intact. What else is still intact? That, this. That's partly intact. We need to bring those things together. You know, look for what is working. I've been working on dam issues in Patagonia and in Tibet, and especially with the Chinese, I found the protesters, the people who I know who are fighting the dams in China, they figured out the way to do it is to go to the Chinese government and say, this river that's undammed here, you've done such a good job, as opposed to saying, these places you have destroyed, this is awful. And because they come back to me and they go, God, whenever we say that, they say, oh, great, we'll put up another dam just to piss you off. And as opposed to saying, this river is so beautiful, and members of the Chinese government have responded saying, oh, yeah, you're right. We should keep right. that continuity.
So tell us a little bit more about, in your own work, about knowing and, I would say, listening to water. You're both experiential learners, next to and atop and oftentimes inside or in water that you write about. But you balance books and erudition with your work outdoors. Has that balance stayed roughly the same across your career? Or does the balance change between what we might call indoor study and outdoor study?
I used to think that it was a metaphor, listening to rivers. I used to think that that was a way of saying, you know, pay close attention. And, of course, that's a good idea. Until I went out with an acoustic ecologist, and that blew my mind. Because what he showed me was he had me listening to rivers that were coming from different places. So we went up into this great rainforest in Washington, and we listened to this beautiful stream. And you could hear all these different tones to it. It was a deep, deep, wonderful chord with the treble tones and the deep chords. And then he moved some rocks and he said, listen, I'm going to change the tuning of this. And he moved rocks and it was a different chord that it played. And then we went into the place where water was running off of a clear cut and we listened to that. It wasn't a chord. It was just a single lonely thread of music. And so I suddenly realized that listening to streams, they are speaking to you, and they can tell you how rich and glorious their life is or not. So, yes, I think that listening to streams is a pretty interesting idea.
And I can't write without being out there, because it's too hard for me to write inside a closed space, because the story is, all you have to do is walk outside and the story starts telling itself. I mean, I feel like what I'm writing is usually just me going, uh-huh, yeah, oh, yeah, you know, just responding to what's going on around me. And you know, sometimes I'm, you know, on furious deadline in a book, glued to my computer screen for weeks at a time, and I start to forget. And I can see that the writing starts to decay because I forgot what it sounded like. What it smelled like, because I'm just trying to go, okay, how does this sentence work? How does that paragraph? Did you get the right research in there? Where's your footnote? It really separates you from being out there in it. And so I write out there. I leave. I write on everything that I have and mm-hmm. outside somewhere where it's happening.
Yeah.
It's all over my hands.
We'll ask just another couple of questions, then we'll turn to you all for questions and comments for Craig and Kathleen. You both write quite a bit about your family in your books. What do you tell them about water?
I don't tell them anything. I mean, really, we just go. I find that I don't tell my children the stories, which, good and bad, I just say, let's go out and do it. And you guys, let me watch you guys run around in it. And I don't talk to them about it. I hope that they pick it up, and I hope that they never read anything that I write, that they just go off and do their thing out there. But for my children, I just try to make a doorway to go, look at this cool thing, go run around in it, taste it, drink it.
Me too, except I say don't drink it.
That's what my wife says. She says, Craig, stop telling them to drink the water.
Well, in your work and in the reception of your work, we hear a lot of influences and comparisons to great and lasting environmental writers. You both have been mentioned in sentences with Emerson and Thoreau. You're both students, I suspect, of Rachel Carson. We hear Edward Abbey in your work. I think we hear John Wesley Powell in your work. I'm going to close by calling up another writer who I suspect is quite familiar to you both, and someone whose work, or at least in the paragraph I'm going to read as we close here, reminds me very much of the two of you. And this is Norman MacLean, a writer and an academic who wrote so movingly of time and faith and water and the American West, particularly in this paragraph. Eventually, all things merge into one, and a river runs through it. The river was cut by the world's great flood and runs over rocks from the basement of time. On some of the rocks are timeless raindrops. Under the rocks are the words, and some of the words are theirs. I am haunted by waters. I think it's fair and entirely appropriate to say that our two guests this evening, unless I'm making a mistake of interpretation, are equally haunted by water. And by virtue of that, and their fascination and love of water, we are the great beneficiaries of this work, both in terms of our conversation this evening, but also in the published work that they've done and the work they'll continue to do. So before I turn to you all for questions and comments, please join me in thanking our two guests. This conversation, I could go on till midnight, but that wouldn't be fair to you all. So thank you so much. So we have some time for questions and comments, and we invite you to speak into the microphone as it makes its way around the room.
This is for Craig. We've all heard about what climate change is doing to the ice caps and the mountains and everything. What have you experienced in your career of how it's changing the desert?
Right now, and for the last 5 years, I've been watching dust storms blowing out of Utah into Colorado. I live on the west side of the Rockies, so I can almost see into Utah. And this is just one aspect, and who knows how long this will continue, but this dust has been blowing in these incredible billowing storms that I haven't seen. I've lived out there off and on for 25 years, and I've only seen them in the last 5 years, and these storms are coming 4 or 5 times every spring. And so the mountains that were white turn pink. And that pink causes the snow to melt rapidly. And so we're losing our water. You know, the main reservoir for the summer is up there in the snowpack. We're losing it before July, where we used to have it on into August. And so it's very clear. You can really see it. This is what happens when deserts move. When they expand, you can see it piece by piece, that they blow into the mountains and they melt the snow. The irrigation canals or the ditches are empty come August, as opposed to empty come September. So, you know, that's just one piece, but it's a piece that I can see very clearly, because when these dust storms come through, they often come with a bit of rain, and it's just like you're driving and it's like blood on your windshield. The windshield wipers just moving the red dust of Utah, and you can see one state moving into another.
Yes, how do you see the Oglala Aquifer playing into your narrative? And connected to that, and Oglala is named after the Lakota Sioux, and your narrative tied into your story tied into the indigenous people.
Me. Well, it's aquifers draining is the same story everywhere. I feel like I look more toward the aquifers in Arizona, especially under the Navajo Reservation and the Hopi Reservation, where you talk to people who say these springs were running 50 years ago, and they're not running now. So going to people who've been in a landscape for a period of time is one of the critical pieces of information that most of us don't have. I mean, we look at aquifers and we can see, oh, they're dropping at this rate, but what does that really mean? We don't know. What does it mean to people who have lived there for generations? That's when you find out what's going on. That's when you learn, oh, that spring ran for a very long time. That was a dependable spring, and it's gone now. There's no water coming out of it at all. And I think having that access to stories, to memories, is something that we miss in the scientific realm, because then it's just numbers. Then it's just, you know, lowering by what rate. That changes when there's actually a person there telling you the story. And that's what I pick up, especially from, I mean, Hopi and Navajo are that's more in my area. So that those are the stories that I hear. But then there are also the stories of, you know, there's the people come from an underground lake, from an underground source. Everything is told from this story of water underground, and that's where you start. I mean, my book House of Rain, the title House of Rain is the name of that place that's underground. The House of Rain is a water body that exists below us. And as I started learning the stories, I discovered, oh, these old cosmologic stories are the hydrologic cycle. They're telling a story about water moving in these circles, and that's not something that we think about that often. We don't have that embedded in us necessarily, and to talk to people who have it embedded in them from generations, from living in dry country, I think really changes your perspective.
Here's one up front.
Can you give us your projection of what water would be like compared to Earth, what we find at the bottom of Lake Vostok in Antarctica, and what we may find under the surface of Europa? And also, can you tell us what you think of your of the work of Gerald Pollack at the University of Washington?
I can't
either, but I can. you know, when I find it interesting that we go out into the solar system and even into the universe in a way looking for water, that we look around quasars and see signatures of water out there. It's, you know, I wonder what our intentions are. Is it just that we're constantly fascinated with water, that we look out to Europa, to Mars, to the moon, the way that I walk into the desert, just looking for signs of it, or do we have an intention? So I really wonder where that's going. That's on my mind a lot. Like, is this just an instinct we have to look for it, or are we anticipating something? I was talking to I was with an ice researcher in Greenland, and we were up on the polar ice cap. And he was telling me that he had put the X on the map to put one of the deep drilling wells in Antarctica, and I think it went down 3,000 meters. I may be entirely wrong on that number, but they were just getting close to the bottom of the ice, and he said, you know, we're really worried because we don't want to break through. And I said, well, what's the problem with breaking through? And he said, well, you know, the entire column is filled with chemicals, with just a heinous cocktail to keep the thing from closing. And if we break through, all that will go down into the water that's underneath it. And, you know, and I was still going, well, yeah, but there's a lot of water in Antarctica under the ice, right? So this, what could this really do? And he said, well, you, if anybody, should know that wherever there's water, there's life. So there's going to be something under there that has been trapped, that has been evolving, possibly for millions of years. And we're talking about our first contact being opening this up and just dumping poisons into it.
Oh,
and it was, in a way, really heartening for me to hear a scientist who I would think would just be saying, well, let's get this thing done, let's get the data, let's go, for him to go, we can't do this. And this is, you know, I see that water as the same as the water on Mars, as, you know, this is a different kind of water.
Hi.
Hi.
We went up to the Northern California coast over Memorial Day weekend and was struck by how green it was. And then we drove home through the agricultural Central Valley, how brown it was. But we also saw these surfeit of signs protesting water wars and water allocations and water denials. Do you know what that's all about?
It's everywhere. who has prior rights?
How much does it cost?
Yeah, yeah. Who? Where's the water coming from? Who owns it? I don't know in particular what this issue is.
No, Bill might know.
Well, a lot of that has to do with differential price structures. So it's state water versus federal water, private agency water, etc. So anytime you've got those differing supplies and differing price structures, there's going to be political battles on top of them. So that's part of it. And it's also some regulatory debates about water use and what it's to be used for and how far you get to move it to use it for this or that. So, and it's not going away. It's only heating up. Yeah. It's fascinating politically.
You mentioned that you were pleased by the response of this scientist.
Yeah.
To respect the nature of the life underneath Antarctica. But do you feel like this is a? Do you feel like there's any type of a paradigm shift grabbing hold? Do you think that people are starting to, people who would normally be in positions where they would, ignore the interests of the ecology or whatever? Do you think that this type of thing is changing?
I don't know if I've been alive long enough to answer that. How many centuries do you have to be alive before you notice?
One of the results of the work we did with this Moral Ground book was that almost every person who responded, we asked about 100 of the world's moral leaders to talk about our obligation to future generations, and one of the messages that was very clear, and almost in every response, was that we are on the cusp of a paradigm shift. And it's a shift between two worldviews. A worldview is an answer to three central philosophical questions. What is the world? What's the place of a human being in the world? And how then shall we live? And we've been living for hundreds of years with the notion that humans are apart from and above and in some way in control of the rest of the world, which was designed and placed here for our purposes and derives all its values from its usefulness to us. And that has been revealed over time to be a profoundly dangerous point of view. I mean, if that's an experiment to see if people can live well thinking that, then the results of that experiment seem to be in. We haven't been able to do that. And so what they're anticipating is a shift to a point of view that really recognizes the interdependence of all being and the notion that the well-being of any part is deeply intertwined with the well-being of the rest, and that we human beings are not exceptions to the rules. We are also very much part of these beautiful webs of being, and that our, it was Aldo Leopold who said that the first premise of any ethic is that the individual is a member of a community of interdependent parts. And so the hope is that if people can come up with this different worldview where they understand themselves as being intricately and interdependent, that might lead to different ways of interacting with the world. So I am actually quite hopeful that that is happening.
And I think if you look at science over the last century, you see it. You see the change, which possibly comes from understanding how complex things really are. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we're coming to now is we're starting to see, oh, this affects that, which affects this, the nonlinear nature of natural systems is becoming much more clear, which I think is changing the paradigm. But I don't know how fast these things change.
Uh, I found it very evocative when Craig was describing moving through the landscape, moving through the desert. And I know that, for instance, Matt Katamiba in the Grand Canyon is a place that I return to in my mind and my heart as kind of a sanctuary. And I was hoping that you could both address sacred spaces for you in the landscape.
Well, with a name like Matt Katamiba, it's already like it's one of those places that stands out. I sometimes wonder if there is no one place that's more sacred than another. That even, you know, I don't know if you know Glenwood Canyon in Colorado, where I-70 goes through the canyon. I look at it and I go, is this less sacred because there's an interstate going through it, or is this just as sacred as it's always been? And I guess it's more that you have a personal reflection on a place. There are certain canyons I go back to over and over and over again, and they are sacred for me. They are these places where time reveals itself. But you could be in the next canyon over from me saying the same thing about that, or the next boulder, or it just keeps going on. I don't think the sacredness really has any boundary.
I think that's a really good point. I call myself a believer in the secular sacred. And what I believe is that this world that we inhabit, not another world on another plane, is beautiful and mysterious and irreplaceable and contingent and extraordinary and awesome in every sense of that word. And if the good English word for that is sacred, then that's fine with me. And so I do believe that we go out the door into the sacred morning, and we walk on the sacred grass, and we breathe the sacred air. I don't know any way around that. And as for sacred places, I agree with Craig that they are everywhere, but I also think that there are places that speak very, very strongly to us, and that they are often places of water. Yeah.
Well, just to add to that, there are those spots.
Yeah.
Where some landform really stands out. I live under a rock tower in Colorado, and it's just this thing that sticks up out of the ground. And the only reason I live there is because this thing sticks out of the ground. I could have lived anywhere, but I saw it and went, oh, this is the spot. And I've spent 15 years walking around this rock and finding a spot where in the spring a little seep of water comes out of a crack, and it only lasts for maybe 3 weeks. It's, you know, old snow melt that's melted through the heart of the rock. And, you know, that's a place that I return to, and I think we need those places. And maybe they're not all landscape. Maybe it's, you know, someplace in the city, or someplace architectural. But we need a place. We need something to go, I know that. I see that over seasons. I see that change. I think that is, if you call it sacred, that's what it is.
Some of my most extraordinary experiences are going to a place out in eastern Oregon where I just feel so right there. And it just seems like such an amazing place. And I'll sit there trying to understand, and I'll look down at my feet and I'll see obsidian flakes. And know that other people have felt that same thing about that place.
So is it a thing? Is there something there?
Or a feeling?
Is there something physical about it? Or is there something mystical about it that makes you aware? Or it's... But you know what it is.
You know what it is.
You walk there and you say, oh, here's the spot.
How many people here have been in such a spot?
Yeah. Here's a question right here.
I kind of have two questions for either or both of you. I once had a professor who also worked for the city of Simi Valley in the water services, who told my class that in the very near future, people will be fighting over water more than over anything else. I was wondering what your thoughts are on that. And the second question is, speaking as someone who is in the future hoping to be an ecologist and probably an educator as well, how do you affect change in people? Like, how do you shift people's priorities? Because that seems to me that that's where the beginning of change in the world comes from.
Well, my colleague at Oregon State University, Aaron Wolf, who has studied water treaties that cross boundaries, makes an unusual argument. He says he thinks that there are very few cases of where people actually came to war over water, and that, in fact, people overlook the vast majority of times where it's water that people are negotiating over and coming up with treaties about while their nations are at war over land. So I wouldn't be quick to agree with your professor. Sorry. I know that's disloyal.
Well, and I often hesitate myself to change people, to direct a change. I think I'm going to tell this story, and that person will decide how they want to change from my story. Now, we all do it differently, but I just want to be a catalyst and hope that I can kind of nudge things along to, I can say, well, here's all the information I have, and you know, here's what I think about it. And this is not necessarily how you should think about it, but this is, you know, put this in your basket. You know, put my thoughts in with yours, and we will be part of this evolution together. It may not go where I want it to go, where you want it to go, but it will go somewhere. And so I just think, keep adding fuel to the conversation. Keep the conversation moving. I don't feel like I am wise enough to say, this is what we should be doing now, and this is where we should be going. God, don't listen to me. But I can say, there is something here that's really powerful, and I think you feel it too, here.
That's the key here. Sentence right there.
And then we just trade stories. And that's how I think we move these things along.
Yeah. You know, one of my graduate students did a project where she was, where she got students on campus to sign up to do 6 things that would reduce their carbon footprint. And after they all committed to these 6 things, after 6 weeks, she went back and asked them what caused them to change their practices. And I'll never forget the day she burst into my office and she said, Dr. Moore, the only thing that's statistically significant is hope. And that may be true, that the idea that you can make a difference, the idea that you are empowered to actually improve things, I think might be the one thing that moves people to action.
In the back.
This is for Dr. Moore. I've been paying attention to the news of Oregon and everything, and I still have family there, and they've told me that their winters seem to have gotten less. They don't last as long. Do you think that's going to affect the water supply around Oregon and the greenery that I remember as a child?
Yes. What we have and what is predicted that we will have, and what's consistent with predictions having to do with climate change, is that more and more of our precipitation will fall as rain rather than snow. So we will have reduced snowpacks, and it's the snowpack that irrigate the fields. So we would anticipate having water crises in the agricultural lands, even in Oregon, and we would anticipate also changes in the forests, because the forests are under a great deal of attack from insects that have not been killed by hard winters, and so the trees are dying at far greater rates than they had been before.
I'm curious about water in cities. How a lot of the stuff you guys are talking about is really nature, and I think for me it's like the human connection, community in cities and stuff like that. So I'm curious to hear your connections and stories about that.
I like I said about the faucet and the car wash water. I don't want to say it doesn't matter where the water is, but. You know, look at a fountain in the city, and there are people all around it. Whenever I see that, I go, "Oh, there's something going on there." And even though you know, I think you know the fountains strewn across Las Vegas and Phoenix are a bit obscene. At the same time, I look at them and say, "This verifies our connection to this thing, that we need this, that we need to see water coming out of the ground." When it rains in the city, when it's washing down the street, the sound of car tires on asphalt that's wet in a rainstorm, like it's a beautiful sound. And, you know, I don't think it should be limited to just being in what we call nature. It's wherever water does its thing. That's where you go. That's where you go and pay attention.
Kathleen?
We drove out to Oregon from Ohio in the middle of winter. We arrived January 9th or something like that in the about 10 o'clock at night, and we drove in. It was pouring down rain, and we drove into a gas station, and the man said, "Would you like us to wash your windows?" And and without thinking, my husband said, "Sure." So he takes his whole bucket of water and just goes, poosh, and sloshes it across the window. And then the next morning, what was delightful to us was seeing children out in the gutters making dams and playing around in the water in the gutters. So, yes, water is water, and how beautiful it is in the city. It's true. And how it can bring people together in the city, too, in a celebration.
Well, thank you all very much for your attention, your excellent questions. Please join me in thanking and please support the Los Angeles Public Library, the Foundation, and...
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Aloud theme was composed by Larry Karish.